Scrambling around an eccentric uncle's tall, skinny row house in New York would seem to be a treat for any child, all the more so if your uncle were Andy Warhol and the house his art studio. James Warhola is just that nephew, and a new book called Uncle Andy's Cats. He writes of the fun he had visiting his Uncle Andy. Daniel Pinkwater is our ambassador to the world of children's literature. He joins us from his home in upstate New York. Daniel, thanks so much for being with us.
Scott, I am speaking from Dog Camp.
Dog Camp.
I'll explain in a moment, but first I have to share sad news.
Yeah.
Our Lulu is no more.
I'm sorry, Daniel. This was a dog who was on our show and, well, several other programs because you taught her how to read.
Our Canadian Inuit sled dog, known to listeners of this program and others, she was certainly the most remarkable dog and my dear friend.
Yeah.
But we are experienced dog people, and while we will never know another dog like Lulu, we know we will know other dogs. And in her fifth day with us is Key, a formerly horribly abused, we're calling her a Georgian Shepherd. That's a German Shepherd mix from the Atlanta area. She was in bad shape as recently as May, but she's healthy now. And we've dropped everything, and we're devoting two solid weeks. And it's an intensive training program for her and for us. It's sort of like boot camp, only we're 67 and she's like a teenager. I hurt in a lot of places.
Oh, yeah.
So to business.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, James Warhola is the nephew of Andy Warhol. And Uncle Andy's Cats, which we want to talk about today, is a companion book to Uncle Andy's A Fabulous Visit to Andy Warhol. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't have to read the first book to enjoy this one, but read it. It's brilliant. So, in Uncle Andy's Cats, we're back in the brownstone where Warhol lived with his mother and a cat. Let's read it and talk about the pictures.
Okay. Uncle Andy said it all started with a little blue pussycat named Hester. She was just a kitty when I got her from a fabulous movie star called Gloria.
I think that's fabulous.
Oh, okay. She was just a kitty when I got her from a fabulous movie star called Gloria. And by the way, if that's not Gloria Swanson in this illustration...
Little Hester just loved Uncle Andy's house. It was tall and skinny and perfect for dashing up and down stairs and hiding among the antiques. The only time Hester was still was when she was staring at Grandma Bubba's Mina Bird Echo.
On our visits to Uncle Andy's, we would look and look, but still couldn't find little Hester.
And this illustration shows the nephews and nieces prowling around amongst the objet d'art,
yeah,
antiques, Warhol works, and junk.
Yeah.
Little Hester grew and grew and grew and became Big Hester.
Uncle Andy and Bubba thought Hester was lonely. That's when they decided to get Sam. It was love at first sight.
A montage of the cats eating together, chasing a mouse together, playing with a ball of yarn and the mouse together, chasing the mouse again, and the cats and the mouse sharing a cushion. Uncle Andy enjoyed Sam and Hester's company when he painted late at night in his studio. When it was bedtime, the cat's favorite spot was Uncle Andy's wig drawer.
On one visit, there were kittens. Lots and lots of kittens. Uncle Andy said, "It's so marvelous. Hester is now a mommy." Bubba said, "They all look like their papa, so let's name them each Sam."
The little Sams loved their tall, skinny house, too.
The only time we ever saw all the Sams was when Bubba called them for their favorite meal, oatmeal and liver.
Oh. And we see the kids peering in the door and saying, "Holy smoke." Uncle Andy said that the Sams liked us best when we were sleeping, and I think Uncle Andy did too. Here's the kids camped out in improvised beds amongst the artworks and plenty of cats, and a Warhol standing there, avuncular, watching the whole scene.
I've never seen Andy Warhol in my imagination, let's put it that way. We always loved snooping around at Uncle Andy's, and one day we got another surprise. Hester and Sam were a mommy and daddy again.
The kid says, "Holy macaroni." The kittens all looked just like their daddy, so they were also named Sam, and that made for a whole lot of Sams.
Uncle Andy was sometimes interrupted when a herd of Sams would stampede through his studio, and the neighbors were interrupted when the Sams would sneak up to the roof.
I love the stampede picture.
Oh, my. There must be 25 cats there.
Yes. And the Sams loved to rumble amongst my uncle's soup boxes. At the end of a long day, they found that sleeping in Uncle Andy's room was very comfortable.
Now Bubba and Echo had a little bit too much company. Andy, there are just too many Sams, Bubba told him. But Uncle Andy didn't know what to do.
We brought three Sams home with us, but that didn't work out too well when they wouldn't come down from the roof.
Finally, Uncle Andy had a plan.
Uncle Andy and Bubba drew and painted the most marvelous portraits of Hester and the Sams. After many days of working, the art was finally ready to be sent to the printer.
And this is such a busy two pages, isn't it? Between
yes.
The cat pictures and the rocking horse and the, you know, Andy Warhol at his, and Bubba, his mother, also at the drawing board.
Yes, and he's taped his sketches up on top of his Marilyn Monroe portraits. And there's plenty of detail. You can study this one for a long time.
Uncle Andy and Bubba each created a fabulous book. Uncle Andy's was called 25 Cats Named Sam and One Blue Pussy. And Bubba named hers Holy Cats.
By Andy Warhol's mother. The books were a huge hit, and the Sams became famous overnight. Everybody wanted a Sam. They came from uptown and downtown to get a Sam.
Now the house is quiet. In no time at all, things were just about back to normal, and that made Uncle Andy and Bubba very, very pleased.
As it turned out, Hester and Sam were just the right amount of cats for their tall, skinny house.
Oh.
Now, James Warhola is a pretty good illustrator.
He's a wonderful illustrator.
They're wonderful, wonderful drawings. And, you know, I hit New York just when Andy Warhol was stealing the show. Pop art was just happening, and he was the star. And I just assumed he was, you know, some guy who paid his dues and hit it lucky. I imagine a lot has been written about him. But I would not be surprised if the best inside look at Warhol the artist comes from this childhood reminiscence of Warhol the uncle. And although I was never a fan before, now I am.
Yeah. Daniel, thanks so much for bringing this to our attention. The book is called Uncle Andy's Cats by James Warhola. Daniel Pinkwater has written many fine books for children and for adults. His latest novel is now serialized for free on pinkwater.com. It's Adventures of a Cat-Whiskered Girl. I haven't seen this yet. All right, Daniel, thanks so much.
It was a complete pleasure.
Jamie Terababe spent much of the last decade as a foreign correspondent, including 3 years as NPR's Baghdad bureau chief. Now she's back in the U.S., and she's just returned to work after maternity leave.
There are things you witness as a war correspondent. The tragic scenes, the grieving relatives, the smoke, the ruin, the blood. More often than not, those things stay in your stories. It affects you for a moment, then you move on. You have to, or you'll never do your job, and people will never know what's going on. Then there are the things that don't make it into your reporting. The people on the sidelines, those whose voices aren't as loud as everyone else's. They're usually children. They were always my favorite people. Wherever I went, I took photos of little kids. They love posing for pictures, and I loved showing them how they looked. But I didn't think I was such a softie. I wasn't really until my son was born, and then everything made me cry. I wasn't prepared for this. Life as a war correspondent is rather solitary. You don't have to consider anyone but yourself. Motherhood is the total opposite. I've gone from the no responsibility zone to one in which a tiny person demands my attention, my time, my love, and my care. It's the perfect antidote to selfishness. And now I see my old world everywhere in this new one. Sometimes when he's playing with a new toy, he looks up at me and smiles. Then I think of other children who never had anyone smile back at them. I can't help it. I remember all the children I ever saw in tattered clothes who didn't have homes, let alone toys, but looked up and smiled at me anyway. I remember children standing on the sides of streets in Baghdad, their faces smeared with grease as they hawked black market gasoline. I remember the young girls and boys crisscrossing traffic jams in Jakarta, selling boxes of Kleenex and chewing gum to motorists. I remember meeting a little Iraqi girl on the verge of prostitution. I could see it in the glitter on her chipped fingernails and the smeared rouge on her cheeks. I think of the countless funerals for dead children I've witnessed, all victims of war. All these children who never had a childhood, who had to grow up too soon. I think about them when I look at my little boy. He's thriving before my eyes, and soon words will replace his grunts and coos. Those legs that constantly kick will hoist him upward and forward. I want him to take his first steps laughingly, with next to no fear about what'll come next. I want him to know I'll be watching, ready to catch him, that his little milestones are more heart-stopping than any war zone could ever be. But I also know that as he explores this world with happy wonder, I'll be thinking of those countless other innocents who never had that chance.
Jamie Terabay was NPR's Baghdad bureau chief. Now she's a correspondent living stateside with her husband and infant son, Jake.
When Jana Arshansky was 14 years old, she and her family were rounded up by German forces where they lived in the Ukraine. They were being marched off toward mass graves to be executed when her father, Dmitry, bribed a Ukrainian guard to look the other way while she ran into the forest. "I don't care what you do," he told her, "just live. Go." She had just the clothes she was wearing and a copy of Chopin's Fantasy Impromptu in her pocket. Jana Arshansky was a piano prodigy at the age of 6. The story of how she and her sister Frina survived the war by playing piano for German soldiers is told by her son, Greg Dawson, in his new book, Hiding in the Spotlight. Greg Dawson, who's also a columnist at the Orlando Sentinel, and Jana Arshansky join us from the studios of WABE in Atlanta. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's very exciting.
Mr. Dawson, I gather you grew up in Bloomington, Indiana, without knowing your mother's extraordinary story.
That's correct. I knew growing up that my mother was different from the other moms in the neighborhood. She was Russian. She spoke Russian and English to me. She practiced piano for several hours a day. And I also knew in a vague sense that she had been through the war. But I really knew nothing about the story that's outlined in the book until essentially I was 30 years old when NBC showed the Holocaust miniseries. And so I thought I would call my mother, who was then living in Milwaukee, to see if I could get a few anecdotes or something that might relate from her war history that might relate in some way to this miniseries.
Jana, if I may call you Jana, because that's
how
you're referred to in the book. Why didn't you tell your son?
I thought about it all the time, but I didn't dare because I just didn't know how I can burden them with such horrors at a gentle age.
I am, of course, going to have to get you, with your son's help, to tell this extraordinary story. There you were. Got caught up or pretended to get caught up in a fence so that the group of people who had been taken and were taken off for execution, which included your father, walked past. You essentially assumed a new identity. Anna Morozova.
Well,
thank you.
Morozova.
I don't believe I've ever asked a question and it's anything like this before, but Jana, how did you and your sister come to perform for Nazi soldiers?
Oh, we did it all the time. The Germans had a sort of a place to live, I would say, like the distance of a couple of blocks from the orphanage that we found, and we were hiding with false names. And the orphanage was filthy. and was very hungry and very awful, but we thought it was the best place, and we really didn't care about food or cleanliness. When you're in this condition and people come, there was a piano, so we sit down and play, and since nobody was around, we were safe, we thought. But the piano tuner came, and the director said to me, I mean, the head of the orphanage told me, look, I'm paying this guy money, but I don't want to pay him until he finishes the job and you try the piano. If this is satisfactory, I'll give him his pay. If not, I'm not. So I sat down and I played. And he just didn't say anything. He said, some more, please. So I played some more. He said, what's going on? I've been here tuning and watching you. You have no food. You have little babies. You have dirt. Why are you here? He said, that's ridiculous. You can play piano as if nobody else plays piano like this in our town here in Kremenchug. Why? You can go right away and live better. And we said, oh, no, we like it here and everything. He said, I'm not leaving it alone. I'm coming back. And we were terrified. But he came back. And he came back again. And so Afrina and I, we decided that it's time for us to agree to go into town with him. And he came and took us there and took us right into the music school with a wonderful director. The director of music school was a friend of the director of the theater, which was holding shows for soldiers every day, I mean, most of the days of the week. Mm-hmm. And they needed a pianist. So
that you had ballet dancers.
For, yes.
Who needed to practice, and they needed music, right.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, you really cannot dance without music. So the director hired me right away. I had to play for the early in the morning. I would go and start playing for the ballet. And then all the rehearsals with singers, with other instrumentalists or jugglers, they wanted music too, you know. And so I was busy all day, but I didn't care. It was all right with me, you know, playing and everything.
But you'd look into the audience and you'd see German soldiers.
Mm. Oh, yes, I knew they were there.
The people who must have scared you most in the world.
You know,
hell,
who
they still scare
more?
Some of us.
No, let me tell you who would scare you more.
Yeah.
If you had a false name and if you knew that many people can recognize you, those are the people that would scare you. So you're right. Playing for Germans was very different, but the pieces were the same that I played. So if the piano was good, I could handle it.
Shana, how did you come to perform in labor camps?
Oh, because that was in Germany. Mm-hmm. Because there were labor camps called Ost. You know, in German language, it's East. And the Germans who were organizing concerts for German army now were sending us to these Ost workers. Every day we would be playing for a different Ost camp. That's what the Germans did. I guess all the armies always trying to mitigate the life of a soldier. And if you have music and dance, it's entertaining.
Greg Dawson?
Yes.
The names of... this is extraordinary. The name of your mother and her sister are inscribed in the list of the dead of the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial in Israel.
That's right.
Yes, they are still listed among the dead at Yad Vashem, and their names are also etched into the wall of a memorial outside Kharkiv where 16,000 Jews were murdered, including her parents and grandparents. And that's because it was presumed that nobody had escaped those death marches. And as far as I know, they're the only two of the 16,000 who escaped.
Shana, you and your sister came to the United States after the war. You wound up going to Juilliard. You wound up performing and teaching at Indiana University in Bloomington.
Yes, yes.
What an amazing arc in your life. What an amazing life.
Yeah. Yes, there's, what kind of a planner did that to me? You know, now I go to synagogue and I have wonderful rabbis there, and I'm beginning to think that everything is planned out. Because a Soviet Russian person who never saw a rabbi or synagogue, that is not part of being Soviet Russian. But by going there almost a year now, I really, truly, I know that the world had to be made by somebody. Yes, I think.
Jana?
I think there is a God, yes.
You know, Jana, I guess we have a recording of you playing that we're going to play.
Yes, how wonderful.
Well, but what are we going to hear?
Oh, it's a quintet, piano quintet by Schumann. He wrote only one, and it has four movements. And it's the third movement of it that is written for the brilliance of a pianist.
So nice talking to both of you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you. It was wonderful. And goodbye.
Goodbye. Jana Dawson, who was a piano prodigy at the age of six, the story of how she survived the war, but playing piano for German soldiers, is told by her son Greg Dawson in the new book, Hiding in the Spotlight. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This week, President Obama addressed a joint session of Congress trying to put some spark into healthcare overhaul. But Congressman Joe Wilson's reaction sparked almost as many headlines as the speech. Afghanistan still sorting through allegations of fraud after its presidential election last month. NPR senior news analyst Dan Chor joins us. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Scott.
And Dan, president's speech was on Wednesday night. After all the back and forth and post-speech analysis,
right?
Did he change the game much?
I think it does change the game in this way. It is now very clear. First of all, I think that the president has recovered his mastery over the debate. Mm-hmm. He sets the terms for the debate. Secondly, I think he's now made it rather clear which way they're going. And clearly, he says, you know, he wants a bill. It may not have everything he wants in the bill, but he just wants to have a bill. And I think that if he has a bill and is willing to compromise on a lot of things, he will probably now get the bill.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps including something about tort reform, perhaps not holding out for a public option?
Perhaps not including the one thing that he thought was really very important to have, and that was a so-called public option, something that would have the government involved in it. That there is considerable opposition to, not only among Republicans but among some Democrats. And I thought he made clear that while he's in favor of this idea, that he's not going to lay his life on the line for it. Mm-hmm. Once you indicate that you're willing to compromise important points, you're on your way to compromise.
Dan, let me put you on the spot. What are the chances for some kind of health care overhaul bill?
Well, now that you put me on the spot, all I can do is say I think that there is likely to be a bill. It's not likely to have a great many of the things that are being talked about today, but the president is insistent. If he doesn't get a bill, that is going to be very, very bad for him and for the Democratic Party. So if he wants a bill badly enough to give up many of the features of it that he wanted, I don't see why he shouldn't get a bill.
During the president's speech on Wednesday, Republican Congressman from South Carolina, Joe Wilson, shouted out, "You lie!" All the analysis that's been done, did he give the president a political gift?
It's very difficult to say. I think that what it tells us is that more than anything else, this country is polarized, increasingly polarized. Mm-hmm. It is polarized at those town hall sessions. It is polarized even in a State of the Union, in a State of the Union situation. And The word simply is that there is nothing that doesn't invite people to yell at each other in this country anymore.
I got some emails, thoughtful emails, this week complaining that the press was overreacting and pointing out that that President Bush had been booed by Democrats, presumably during his State of the Union address in 2005 when he talked about Social Security.
That may well be true, but let me say, speaking purely personally, that when you talk to the President of the United States in a hall of Congress and say, you lied, that is a different order of the things. And I think it's not the same as saying boo or something like that.
In Afghanistan, let's go overseas. More evidence of fraud in the August 20 presidential election. Just on Thursday, results from 83 polling stations were thrown out. Meanwhile, the White House signals that it could be what they call weeks and weeks before the president decides whether to send more troops into Afghanistan, something the military has requested. A lot of congressional Democrats don't like that. Is there any connection between persisting reports of fraud in the election and an indecision over the troop commitment?
Well, I think yes, there is some connection. General McChrystal is presumably getting ready to ask for more troops for Afghanistan. But meanwhile, they're looking at a president who may have stolen the election. And it's very difficult to give that kind of support under those circumstances to President Karzai. On top of which now, Senator Carl Levin, head of the Armed Services Committee, is now coming out against sending combat troops. Mm-hmm. He wants to send only training troops. And so what you're getting is, how do you send a lot of troops to a guy whose government you may find to be illegitimate?
Mm-hmm. There is a chance that the Afghan Electoral Commission itself could mandate a recount, isn't there?
It could mandate a recount. Could mandate a runoff election, mm-hmm. and that at the moment is likely to happen.
And in line with that, a reporter for the New York Times who was kidnapped in Afghanistan last week was rescued this week in a raid by British commandos. His Afghan translator was killed in the raid, as was one of the British soldiers. And now there's some Afghans, notably an association of Afghan journalists who wonder aloud, who complain that there seems to be a double standard between saving the lives of Afghans who've been kidnapped and saving the lives of Westerners.
Yes, it is really so sad that there is nothing anymore today that will not elicit from someone, yes, but the American or the British one working for the New York Times gets rescued, but you don't rescue the local person. There's that seems to come up in almost every connection these days.
Thanks, Dan Shore.
Sure.
President Obama is scheduled to give a speech on Monday about the nation's financial collapse. He'll mark the anniversary of the collapse of the investment bank Lehman Brothers. Over the past year, bank failures and government bailouts have changed the country's competitive landscape. Some industries have actually watched business bloom in the downturn, and NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
A busy corner in Seattle's University District is a good place to start our search for winners and losers.
We're sitting on the steps of a Chase Bank at the corner of 43rd and Brooklyn.
Alan Hess, a finance professor at the University of Washington, says this Chase Bank used to be a branch of Washington Mutual, the largest savings and loan in the country. But Hess says WaMu suffered huge losses from far too many subprime loans.
And so, bam, they were gone.
The company was bought for pennies on the dollar by J.P. Morgan Chase. Other big-name financial firms have also disappeared.
We essentially went through the 100-year flood in financial services. You know, some people are still floating, and there's a lot of wreckage as we see the water move out.
Fred Cannon is chief equity strategist at Keefe, Bruyette & Woods. Right now, two of the strongest institutions are J.P. Morgan Chase and the former investment bank Goldman Sachs. Bear Stearns, Wachovia, and Merrill Lynch were all taken over by bigger companies. Lehman Brothers failed outright. Cannon says the government played a role in determining winners and losers, in part by propping up financial institutions deemed too big to fail.
They said, okay, here's 19 banks, or over $100 billion. We're going to stress test them, but we're also going to ensure they get enough capital to get by. They chose the winners. Each of those 19 are around today. They're all survivors.
And they have less competition than they used to. The competitive landscape in the auto industry has also changed. Last December, then-President George Bush announced he would bail out Chrysler and GM.
In the midst of a financial crisis and a recession, allowing the U.S. auto industry to collapse is not a responsible course of action.
Together, GM and Chrysler got tens of billions of dollars from the federal government, and says Wharton professor John Paul McDuffie, that allowed them to stay in business.
I'd say the biggest losers probably are the dealers that were discontinued by the Detroit Three companies and any of the communities that have closed assembly plants. No matter how well the industry comes back, there's very poor prospects of those dealers or those plants opening again.
Sounds like a car lot.
One dealership that's doing well is Kirkland Ford, the largest Ford dealer in Washington state. Ford didn't need or take any government bailout funds, and dealer owner Jim Wallen says Ford has gotten a boost because of that.
It's big. It's really big, and it's first of all just given an awareness to Ford.
Various surveys show far more people would consider buying a Ford now than a year ago. Wallen says sales are up year over year, and not just because of cash for clunkers.
We're seeing types of shoppers that haven't considered us before. A lot of import buyers.
The auto and finance industries make headlines, but there are other winners and losers too. Consumers are shopping at Walmart, not at Neiman Marcus. They're buying alcohol, but not eating out in expensive restaurants. And they're traveling less. Alfie Johnson, the COO of high-end Candela Hotels, says five-star resorts have suffered the most, in part because of the stigma associated with AIG. Shortly after the government bailed out the insurance giant, the company entertained clients at a very fancy resort. It didn't sit well.
As a result of that, that hotel lost 90% of their group bookings the next day.
No one wanted to look like they were squandering money at that resort or other high-end hotels. But Johnson says for those who are still traveling,
there are some great bargains out there. I mean, it doesn't matter where you look.
Or you could skip the hotel altogether and pitch a tent. At Cascade Designs in Seattle, workers are putting bright green covers over specialized foam to make inflatable mattresses. The company's Ken Maydell says more people are hitting the trails and going camping.
Some of that is probably a desire to get back to basics and things that people remember doing in their youth or in their 20s, and they're looking to rediscover that in an uncertain time, and that seems to be driving participation rates up.
Camping equipment is selling well, so add some outdoor gear equipment companies to the list of firms doing fine in these tough and uncertain economic times. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.